Okay, let me remind you what we're trying to do in this class. We're trying to get at the whole question, what makes for war? What makes for, a great power war? And we're trying to do it by using history as a vehicle, right? And so we're focusing on the great conflicts of the 20th century. First World War, the Second World War in Europe, the Second World War in East Asia, the Cold War. And we're trying to assess different interpretations of what makes for war in those specific historical contexts. And one of the main interpretations is the basic notion that people just absorb growing up, that you get from the general culture around you, which is that to understand a conflict like this, you have to figure out who's to blame. War is not normal. It's not a natural part of the international system. It's caused by a deliberate act of policy. War is willed. War is decided upon by one side or the other. One side or the other decides to initiate the conflict. One side or the other is the aggressor. That's the common view. You go look back at how these great conflicts are interpreted. It's always, who's responsible? Who's the guilty party? Who's to blame? Okay? And in reaction to that general view, there's a very different notion that derives its power from the fact that it's counterintuitive. It's like, no, you can't think of war in those terms. War is not caused by conscious, deliberate decision so much as it's just built into the structure of things. It's a product of the anarchic structure of international politics, the fact that there is no overarching authority, and that a world where no one's going to come to your aid if you get into trouble and you have to kind of look out for yourself. You need to be concerned with your security by acquiring the kind of position that makes you secure, even if doing that's at the expense of other people. And they feel the same way. And they're trying to get an advantage at your expense. And it's that kind of conflict that's a product of the system that leads to war, right? Realist, a certain strand of realist theory argues along those lines. Realist theory insists that it's the structure, the system, that's of fundamental importance. Not statecraft, not diplomacy, not the will of the national leader. Those things are of, at best, secondary, tertiary importance. Right? It's power, the structure of power, power political considerations that can lead even a country that would be very happy to live with things as they were, providing it had some sort of guarantee that everyone else was willing to, also live with things as they were. But absent that guarantee, even a status quo power would be led by the basic nature of the system to behave like an aggressor, right? Basic notions of international relations theory, notions that we, grow up with and so on. How do you get at the issue of who's right? What's the answer? And the basic premise of the course, like I said, is that we get at that by looking at the history through that lens. In particular, the whole story of the origins of the War of 1939, the conflict between Germany and the Western powers over Poland that led to, ultimately, to the Second World War, the greatest cataclysm in human history. Grow up, simple answer. Oh, it's all Hitler's fault. He decided to start the war. He chose to begin the conflict. Yeah, one word answer, very simple answer. What caused the Second World War? Much simpler than the First World War. It's all Hitler's fault. Not every serious historian takes that view. That's why the Sontag book is of real interest in this context. Sontag was the most eminent diplomatic historian of his generation. He was, after all the German diplomatic documents fell into the hands of the victorious allies at the end of World War II, and I mean by that the three Western allies, the United States, Britain, and France, it was decided that the Germans wouldn't be allowed to do what they had done after the First War, which is to say, publish their own diplomatic documents in a selective way in order to get themselves off the hook. In terms of their responsibility for the war. So they had this major project, the three Western allies, of publishing the German diplomatic documents, in fact, in both German and English, at least for the most important series covering the Nazi period. And he was the editor-in-chief of that whole project. He went through all this stuff, especially the documents relating to the year or two before the outbreak of the war, with a fine-tooth comb. In 1957, he published an article in a scholarly journal, in the Journal of Foreign Affairs, which is like the house organ of the American foreign policy establishment, you know, published by the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. I put it on the course website. It's very interesting to read. He drew from that article in the chapter on 1939 in the Broken World book that you have in your course pack. But what's extraordinary is 1957, just 12 years after the end of the war, he was able to kind of analyze this issue in a very professional, very scholarly way, and a way that was at variance with what people had been led to believe, that, you know, with this view, it's all Hitler's fault, right? End of story. Where do you see the argument in that article? The first page and the last page, you know? That's exactly where you want to look when you want to see what an author is trying to convince you of. And he kind of laid it out very clearly. He said, on the first page, from the tangle of evidence, one theme emerges, a theme which has relevance to our own day. You know, all these people are thinking of, what insight can you get from the history that can help us figure out how to conduct ourselves in an era of, in the Cold War era, an era of massive thermonuclear weapons? It's the only way, it's the way in which a succession of diplomatic moves, intended only as preparatory to a still distant trial of strength, developed into a diplomatic crisis involving all of Europe, and eventually precipitated a world war which at the outset Hitler had no thought of starting, and which to the end he hoped to avoid. Right? He got caught up in a process that he had unleashed. He got in deeper and deeper so that everyone came to view this as the crucial test of strength. And he couldn't pull back even if he wanted to. That's the argument. It's quite an extraordinary argument. Very important argument, because it's so much at variance with what we had been led to believe. Not a war of aggression, pure and simple. Okay? And if this is true of Hitler, and who could be more aggressive than Hitler, then, you know, a fortiori, you know, all the more so. You can't apply that aggressor theory to normal conflicts like the First World War or the Cold War, right? You have to think of these things in political terms as having a dynamic of their own, not simply the product of a perverse human will of aggression. Very, very, you know, very important. And and I think this is the main point to take away from the study of the origins of the War of 1939. Okay, Hitler certainly viewed a war with Britain and France as inevitable, because they were not willing to give him what he wanted, namely a free hand to expand in the East, to carve out a great German empire in the East. Why were they not willing to do that? Because if Germany did that, Germany would become so strong that they would be reduced to the level of German satellites. To have any control over their own destiny, to stand on their own 2 feet, they had to be concerned with maintaining the balance of power in Europe, with making sure that there would be limits on German power. Hitler came to understand this by the end of 1937. That's the meaning of the Hulsbach memorandum that I discussed. And he thought a war was inevitable. But when? 1943 to 45. That's when he thought it would happen. In the meantime, you got to strengthen Germany. You got to clear the decks in the east. Hence, clear up the Austrian problem, the Czech problem, the Polish problem, so that Germany could then face Britain and France without having to worry about, you know, any problems on her eastern border. Okay, that's the logic of German policy. Seemed to work. Anschluss in early 1938, followed by the Czech crisis in late 38, and the German annexation of the Sudetenland, followed in 1939 by the German seizure of Prague, which totally transformed British opinion, moved British opinion away from support for appeasement to support for resistance. That was the context in which the Polish crisis unfolded. Hitler kind of put all this pressure on the Poles, thinking that they would give way, or at least that he would be able to have a little war with Poland without Britain and France intervening. And it kept, each side kept upping the ante in the expectation that if only it made clear that it was willing to go further, then the other side would give way. Pure war of nerves, a kind of a crisis of mutual deterrence. Hitler wanted to deter Britain and France from intervening. Britain and France wanted to deter Germany from attacking Poland. Right? And as the crisis developed, both sides got more and more involved. Neither side could pull back. Okay? Important interpretation of the origins of the Second World War. But that's not the only way you can get at the issues that we're concerned with here. There's a second way, and that's the whole point of this lecture I'm going to give today, which is it's going to be an unusual lecture, because it's not about history, but about historiography, about a work of historical scholarship rather than the substantive events. Because the premise here is that, you know, a serious work of history is going to have a theoretical core. It's going to have a certain resonance in the context of some larger theory. So by examining the argument put forth by that historian, by examining a particular historical interpretation, one can get some insight into the general theoretical issue that interpretation is linked with. Right? And in this case, it's this book by A.J.P. Taylor, The Origins of the Second World War, which I asked you to bring to class today. I hope you have, because I'm going to be citing chapter and verse a lot and referring you to specific pages so you could follow along with the whole analysis here. Why is this important? For our purposes, because the interpretation that Taylor lays out was far more extreme than the Sontag interpretation. The interpretation that Taylor lays out does have a certain resonance in terms of these big theoretical issues that we're concerned with. There are certain affinities between the Taylor interpretation and the realist interpretation of international politics. So examining the Taylor interpretation can give us some insight into those issues. But how do you examine things? You know, just read the book and then just give your kind of gut reaction to it? No. There's a method, and it's so important that you learn this method, because when you learn it, it puts you in charge. It puts you in the driver's seat. It allows you to make your mind up for yourself. And what is the method? It's analyzing the structure of an argument. First, identifying the structure of an argument. Trying to figure out what the fundamental core claim is, the thesis of the book, then trying to understand the kind of specific arguments that support that general thesis, and then look at the concrete historical claims that support those arguments. You draw out the structure of the argument in that way. You get at the architecture of the book. And then you look at the claims at the base and try and see whether they hold up, both in terms of their internal logic. Or is the author consistent? Or does the author contradict himself? The test of logic, but also the test of evidence. Does the evidence support those claims? Does the evidence, including the evidence that the author himself gives, does that support the claims that are fundamental to giving some substance for the general thesis of the book? Right? So that's what we want to do. First, get at what the structure of the argument is, and then analyze it. Because if you reach the conclusion that the key claims that support these arguments don't hold up, and either in terms of their logic or in terms of the evidence that's given to support them, then the whole structure collapses, and that tells you something about the theoretical issues that these historical arguments are connected to. Okay, so how do you get at the argument of a book like this? Remember, in the very first class, I talked a bit about how to analyze these arguments. You know, what is he driving at here? What is Taylor trying to convince you of? How do you find out? Where do you look? Just at random in the book? No, there are key places where an author is going to tip his hand, someone like Taylor. Well, there's the title, for example. The Origins of the Second World War. That's a promise to you. The promise to you, the reader, is that I, the author, am going to tell you what the origins of the Second World War are. And so already you're reading the book with a question in mind. What does he think the origins of the Second World War are? How would he sum it up in just a few sentences? And where would you look for an answer? Kind of these key places, the introduction, the conclusion. In this case, you know, remember, first page, last page, chapter titles, all those kinds of things. And if you look at the very last page of the book, page 278, this is, if I remember correctly. Yep. The first couple of sentences in the paragraph that starts at the top of that page, right? The last page in the book, right? This is where an author is going to say, he's going to leave you with a pow. So this is what I've shown in the book. And what does he say here? He says, such were the origins of the Second World War, or rather of the war between the three Western powers over the settlement of Risai. A war which had been implicit since the moment when the first war ended. All right? That's a topic sentence in that paragraph. He said to himself, what does he mean by this? What does he mean by a war over the settlement of Versailles? How would you go about figuring out what he means by this? Well, you look at the table of contents, you know, say, well, where would we find it? The table of contents. You notice the title of chapter 4, The End of Versailles. And in fact, if you were reading this book and you were starting to read chapter 5, on page 87 this is, the very first sentence in chapter 5, what is that? Three words. Versailles was dead. Well, isn't there a puzzle here? See, how could the War of 1939 be a war over the Versailles Settlement when the Versailles Settlement was dead by 1935? That doesn't make sense, does it? What on earth could he mean by this? And the key to the answer there is the final clause in that sentence on page 278. Right after the semicolon, he says, a war which had been implicit since the moment when the first war ended. Again, what does he mean by that? How would you go about figuring out what he meant by that? Implicit since the moment when the first war ended. Which chapter in the book would you look at to try and find the answer to that question of what does he mean by that? If it's implicit since the moment when the first war ended, you look at the chapter titles, which chapter would it be in? The chapter 2, the chapter called The Legacy of the First World War. That's the what was implicit from the time the first war ended? Well, what was the legacy of the war? That's the same sort of issue. So you read that chapter with this question in mind. What does he mean? What's the argument here? What is he trying to get at when he says that this problem was implicit in the way the first war ended? Okay. And so what does he say in that chapter? How does he get at this? What's the key decision that was made at the time the first war ended? This was the decision to allow Germany to essentially remain intact, to deal with Germany as a unified country. And why was it so important? He says this is the decision, he claims, that led to the war. What does he say this? For example, on the bottom, toward the bottom of page 21. Germany, however, remained united, acknowledged by the victors. The decision which ultimately led to the Second World War was taken from the highest and most sensible motives a few days before the First War ended. This was the decision to grant an armistice, you know, to basically a unified German government. Two pages later, the armistice settled the question of German unity as far as the First World War was concerned. Okay. Why was this a problem? He explains why this was a problem on page 24. And this is the key passage in the book. Okay. I should say, you know, when I was an undergraduate, I took this political science course with a guy named Sheldon Wolin. He was a political theorist, and one of the books that we had to read was Thucydides' book on the Peloponnesian War, History of the Peloponnesian Wars. And I couldn't understand. I went into him and I said, this is a political science course. Why are you assigning a work of history like this? And he said to me, it's just so nice of him. He said, well, I'm sure you would agree with me when I say that at the core of every, you know, great work of history lies a certain political theory. And I was going, oh, yes, of course. But in reality, it was one of these extraordinary insights. At the core of an important work of history is a certain political theory, a sense for how politics works. And here, on this page, Taylor lays out his fundamental views about how these things work. It's all power. It's all fundamental power, not forces and being. It's all how strong a country is economically, demographically. Ultimately, these things are controlling. And so he lays it out there in the paragraph that begins kind of toward the middle of that page there. Say, you know, the fact that Germany's left intact, this was the decisive, fateful outcome of the armistice and the peace treaty. The First World War left the German problem unsolved, indeed made it ultimately more acute. This problem was not German aggressiveness or militarism or the wickedness of her rulers. these, even if they existed, merely aggravated the problem. And then you have another clause, which is just the essence of Taylor's style, his kind of counterintuitive style. Or perhaps actually made it less menacing by provoking moral resistance in other countries. And now, the key sentence in the whole book as a whole. The essential problem was political, not moral. However democratic and pacific Germany might become, she remained by far the greatest power on the continent of Europe, with the disappearance of Russia more so than before. She was greatest in population, 65 million against 40 million in France, the only other substantial power. Her preponderance was greater still in the economic resources of coal and steel, which in modern times together made up power. At the moment in 1919, Germany was down and out. The immediate problem was German weakness. But given a few years of normal life, it would again become the problem of German strength. And then he goes on, and he concludes the paragraph, and he says, if events followed their course in the old freeway, nothing could prevent the Germans from overshadowing Europe. Then, even if they did not plan to do so, intentions are not fundamental importance. Structure is of fundamental importance. It's the system, the distribution of power, a country's ability to generate power because of the sorts of resources it possesses. This is what makes history run, according to Taylor. All right? This is why I said before that this theory has a certain resonance in the context of, international relations thought. This has a certain affinity with the realist interpretation of international politics. You know, structure is of fundamental importance. It's the system that matters. It's power that matters, not statecraft. You know, diplomacy, at best on the margin a little bit, but not fundamental. Okay? So it's important. And how does this connect with an interpretation of the events of the late 1930s? It translates into an argument that, contrary to what we'd all been led to believe, you know, Hitler was not terribly important. Statesmen aren't important. These power political realities, that's what's important. Statesman is just this kind of vehicle, a passive medium through which these great structural forces work their effect on the course of events. All right? This is the connection between the general argument he lays out here about how the Second World War is implicit in the way the First World War was settled, that this power political problem is of central importance, and the more specific arguments he makes about Hitler. Right? What does he say about Hitler? This is what shocked people when this book came out in the early 60s. You know, it's like everyone thinks, oh, well, Hitler was this, foaming at the mouth, a rabid warmonger who just loved causing wars and so on. Taylor says, not so. Hitler is basically passive as a statesman. Where do you find him saying this? Well, a number of places. One of them is on page 108, at the very bottom of that page. He says, it was never Hitler's method to take the initiative. He liked others to do his work for him. And he waited for the inner weakening of the European system, just as he had waited for the peace settlement to crumble of itself. He's a waiter. He doesn't push things. Where else? Yeah, page 71, there's a nice passage where he's talking about Hitler. About how his method was patience, how he was a master in the game of waiting, how he never made a frontal attack on a prepared position. at least never until his judgment had been corrupted by easy victories. Like Joshua before the walls of Jericho, he preferred to wait until the forces opposing him had been sapped by their own confusions and themselves forced success upon him. Okay? All very counterintuitive, right? Hitler doesn't change things. It's, you know, he changed everything, Taylor says, internally within Germany, but he didn't change German policy. He scarcely even had a policy, right? You know, he's just this passive medium. Taylor has at one point this, again, this is, you know, the prose is so sparkling, and you're just kind of startled sometimes by some of the things he says, and you say, well, is this guy serious? There was this one sentence, he says, the greatest statesmen are the ones who don't know what they're doing. It's like, again, there's a serious core to that thought, which is, you don't try and impose your own will on events. You just allow yourself to, you know, swim with the tides. Tides that you scarcely even understand. These great geopolitical forces which are really shaping the course of events. You don't want to fight those forces. You want to swim with them. And that's what great statesmen do, according to Taylor, because those are the forces that really shape history. Okay? So how do you go about seeing whether he's right about things like this? Right? We have the general theory, it's all political and not moral, that has a certain affinity with realist thought. It's supported by this whole claim about Hitler, this general claim about Hitler. It's not driving things, not shaping the course of events. He's more passive than that. He allows these systemic forces to do his work for him, right? And to back up that theory, to give it some substance, Taylor has to give you an interpretation of these three specific episodes. The great crises of 1938-39, the Austrian crisis, the Polish crisis, the Czech crisis. He has to present them in a way that interpretation is in line with his general argument about, you know, Hitler not being terribly important, Hitler not forcing the pace, and so what? So and sure enough, that's what he says. Okay. Before we examine those specific claims in terms of the evidence that Taylor gives, see whether he proves that his interpretation of German policy in those crises is valid by citing powerful evidence to support it. Before we do that, we should apply the other test, and this is the test of what I call the test of logic. Is Taylor internally consistent about these things? Well, a lot of the time he says that Hitler had no plans. I'll give you some examples of that. Page 68. This is this whole business where the second half of that page, Taylor says, Hitler changed lots of things within Germany in terms of the nature of the German domestic political system. But he says, in one sphere, he changed nothing. His foreign policy was that of his predecessors, of the professional diplomats of the Foreign Office, and indeed of virtually all Germans. Hitler, too, wanted to restore Germany, free Germany from the restrictions of the peace treaty, to restore a great German army, and then to make Germany the greatest power in Europe from her natural weight. And then he says, "This is, most people don't think this is the case." Uh, What else? Page 108, kind of at the top. Well, actually, kind of in the middle of the main paragraph on that page, he says, whatever his long-term plans, and it is doubtful whether he had any. Okay? It doesn't really have a policy that's distinctive, that separates him out from the straight Simon policy. Probably doesn't even have long-term plans. Page 134. Paragraph that begins in the middle of that page, the second sentence, Hitler did not make plans for world conquest or anything else. Very explicit. Okay? Is he consistent there? The extraordinary thing is you could often find him saying exactly the opposite. On page 70, for example. The very last sentence in the paragraph that ends in the middle of that page, he says, nevertheless, Eastern expansion was the primary purpose of his policy, if not the only one. So he was intent on doing more than simply making Germany the number one country in Europe. He wanted to expand in the East, wanted to conquer territory in the East. Well, this is somewhat at variance with what Taylor had said before. Okay. Page 103. Kind of toward the bottom of that page. He says, Hitler probably intended a great war of conquest against Soviet Russia so far as he had any conscious design. It's just not likely that he intended the war of 1939. But he admits in passing that Hitler did have rather far-reaching goals. 105, 106. Hitler's claim to living space, Lebensraum, sounded more plausible. Plausible enough to convince Hitler himself. So Hitler was a believer in Lebensraum? He took the idea of Lebensraum seriously? Terrell seems to be admitting it here. All right? Inconsistencies. Well, those, when you see inconsistencies of this sort, they're red flags. You're saying, something's wrong here. You know, he's just saying whatever he has to say to support the immediate purposes of his argument. It's not based on a serious, thoroughgoing analysis of what was going on. I'll give you one extraordinary example of this problem of logic. And this is on pages 217 to 18. Paragraph that begins in the middle of page 217. German armaments, he's considering various arguments that people make to the effect that the Germans pushed for war in 1939. German armaments in themselves provide a second possible reason why Germany should drive to war. Germany had established a lead in armaments over the other powers, and this lead would gradually waste away. Hitler himself used this argument, but only in the summer of 1939 when already committed to war. Note that. He's recognizing in passing that Hitler is committed to war, determined to have a war, in the summer of 1939. And the context here is not a specific local war. Okay? But then just about, about eight lines down from there, he says, Hitler was intending to succeed without war, or at any rate with a war so nominal as hardly to be distinguished from diplomacy. Well, that's not quite the same as committed to war. Now, as well, maybe a war, but just a little war. And then you look at the very last sentence in this paragraph, the same paragraph this is, on 218. The state of German armament in 1939 gives the decisive proof that Hitler was not contemplating general war and probably not intending war at all. All right, so we go from he's committed to war in the summer of 1939 to he's probably not intending war at all. in the space of a single paragraph. Now, that's this is quite extraordinary because of the light it throws on Taylor's general method. It's kind of this cleverness, but lack of deep intellectual seriousness. Okay? That's the test of logic. That's one of the basic tests you use when you're assessing the quality of an argument. But as I said, there's also the test of evidence, and there are these three crises that you want to look at, or since I just gave you a little bit about the Polish crisis, let's look at the Austrian and Czech crises and what Taylor says about them. Well, what would you expect him to say, given this basic argument about Hitler being passive? It's like, well, these things just happen without Hitler having much to do about that. And in fact, that's precisely what he does say. I mean, for example, if you look at page 248, okay, and this is an important passage that you would probably want to read with care because it's the first paragraph in the chapter of War for Danzig, the chapter about what led to the outbreak of war in September 1939. And he says in passing that the Sudeten Nazis, like the Austrians before them, built up the tension gradually without guidance from Hitler. Right? That's what he says. If true, that would offer powerful support to his argument. He was just sitting there, in Berlin, daydreaming, or in Berchtesgaden, or wherever he was, and the everyone else is doing these things, and Hitler is just like, well, can't help himself. He's carried away. He takes advantage of a situation that other people have created, but he played no role in creating the situation in the first place. That's an important claim. It has a clear affinity with his argument about Hitler, which, as I say, is very much part and parcel of his general argument about the origins of the war. If you wanted to see whether he substantiated that claim, where would you look? Well, for the claim about Austria, you'd look in the chapter on the Austrian crisis. For the claim about Czechoslovakia, you look at the claim, what he says in the chapter dealing with that affair. And what do you find when you do that exercise? Well, on Austria, for example, he deals with this issue on page 139. He says, Nazi agitation went on as before. Not even Hitler's orders could stop it. Right. Question. Does he give you any evidence to back up that claim? Is there a footnote here? Or anything that would indicate that there's a source for this claim? No, it's just stated in this flat way. And what about the Czech business? Here, look at page 152. Because again, this is quite extraordinary. The last couple of sentences in the paragraph that ends in the middle of that page, 152. Even more than in the case of Austria, Hitler did not need to act. Okay? Others would do his work for him. He merely took advantage of it. Okay? He did not need to act. And then he follows with a detailed discussion. And what does he show in the very next paragraph? And in particular, on the part of that next paragraph that begins on the top of page 153. Okay. On 28 March, he, Hitler, received the Sudeten representatives and appointed Henlein, their leader, his, quote, viceroy. They were to negotiate with the Czechoslovak government, and in Henlein's words, we must always demand so much that we can never be satisfied. And he concludes this paragraph with the following sentence. He, Hitler, screwed up the tension in the hope that something would give somewhere. Well, this is not Hitler being passive. This is not Hitler having no choice or no control over what's going on in the Sudeten areas. He's deliberately screwing up the tension. He's the one who's giving the Sudeten Germans their instructions. Taylor himself shows that in this very paragraph. A paragraph that follows his claim that Hitler wasn't doing anything of that sort. Okay? Now, so what does all this mean? It means when you look at his concrete historical claims, his claim about Hitler was passive with the Sudeten Nazis in 1938, it falls. The claim about Austria, no real evidence. Claim about in the section dealing with the Polish crisis, you know, these very basic contradictions, even within the space of a single paragraph. You know, the concrete historical base for the argument collapses. So you can't argue that Hitler was passive. And that in turn suggests that political, not moral? Well, the moral side. The part that deals with intent, with statecraft, with goals. Things other than structure, other than these impersonal forces, power and so on, how much steel you produce and that kind of thing. This is a great oversimplification, right? And therefore, a kind of pure realist interpretation of this particular episode, which tells us in a sense really is false. The problem is not that there's nothing to the realist view. The problem is not that political factors count for nothing, and that the notion that political factors, the structure of power and so on, is of fundamental importance in international politics is garbage and throw it out the window. You know, it's clear that that plays a role, but it's not the whole story. In fact, it can't be the whole story. Right? Statecraft plays a fundamental role. And the whole trick of doing this kind of analysis is figuring out how to strike the balance between objective and subjective factors, between a structure and statecraft, and so on. And in a sense, the whole Taylor argument, by pushing the realist argument to absurd extremes, helps you understand that point. Helps you understand that you can't make that kind of argument. Why can't you make that argument? Because it can't possibly be true that structure is all that matter, because then you would never have a war. The whole notion is everyone adjusts the structure. You know, if structure is of such fundamental importance, everyone will know that Germany is bound to become the number one power in Europe, and everyone will adjust their policies and accommodate to that fact. They dismantled Versailles. Germany is now the number one country. So the war can't be a war over Versailles. It can't. The problem of German power, it had been solved. Germany is now the number one power. End of story. Everyone's accepted it. On the other hand, if you resist it, and you resist it successfully, as was done after World War II, then you don't have to have a war, because if the forces arrayed against you, the forces keeping you down are so great, then you have no choice but to accommodate to those forces and accept the status that the rest of the world insists on imposing on you. So in neither case, the structure in and of itself be a cause of war. You need statecraft to come into play in order to explain why these political problems eventuate in an armed conflict rather than simply in a change in the status quo. Okay? So that's the substantive insights that you want to take away from doing this kind of analysis. But also, there's even more important than that is the point about method. This is how you have to read these books. You don't read them passively like a sponge. You read them very actively using these techniques. By doing that, you put yourself in charge. You put yourself in control. You put yourself in a position to make up your mind for yourself about these historical interpretations that play such an important role in shaping your understanding of how international politics works. Okay, next time we're going to be talking about the expansion of the war into a world war, and in particular to America's entry into the Second World War in December 1941.